Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does the future of the world lie in the hands of nerds? In an era where significant percentages of human experience now take place in the digital realm, the importance of physical dominance has largely fallen away, while the value of highly specialized intellectual abilities has grown exponentially. In short, it's a good time to be a geek, and soon those who are not born that way might pursue biomedical technology to bring our brains up to speed. How this will change the evolution of the species is a fascinating question that author Mark Rader explores in his new book, Unnatural Selection, Why the Geeks Will Inherit the Earth. Mark, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you. We should start with this. What is the difference between a geek and a nerd?
Well, they say that geeks get things done, whereas nerds tend to cogitate and ruminate on issues. So geek has become really the predominant term for people out there using ideas to change the world.
You open the book with the unlikely story of Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, this like twitchy, skinny, geeky guy, and his Harvard classmates, the Winklevoss twins, who, let's face it, are built like Greek gods, seem to have excellent social skills. What did Zuckerberg have going for him that allowed him to prevail?
That's a very interesting question. I'm not sure he would know the answer to that himself, but I mean, you're right. He was the most unlikely person to take on those, you know, Olympian rowers. But he had a really acute, heightened sensitivity to the digital age in which we live. And he also had some very persistent personality qualities as well. I think also this enabled him to really think outside the box and really sort of doggedly pursue his dream, irregardless of what the people around him thought about him.
The fact that Zuckerberg came out the winner seems to be a sign that the world is changing rapidly. And indeed, the amount of information we consume on a daily basis has tripled since 1980. Is that right?
Oh, I think it's much more than tripled. I think it's probably eight to ten times as much, depending on sort of which demographic you're in. Young people, for example, who are constantly on Twitter or their cell phones, you know, chasing up their social media. See, social media has greatly exacerbated both the speed and the volume of the data that young people are receiving and interacting with.
There are some traits that were not obviously desirable in the past that are now recognized as at least potentially useful, including the kind of obsessive pursuit of specific interests that sometimes goes along with being on the high functioning end of, say, the autism spectrum.
That's right. A lot of, quite a few sociologists believe that there would not be Silicon Valley today without people on the with Asperger syndrome or on the autism spectrum. You're absolutely right. In previous generations, even a high functioning person at the edge of the autism spectrum would probably have difficulties. But these days, a lot of these characters are running the world. In fact, it's incredible the amount of high-performing geeks who are either on the spectrum or have Asperger's.
So what are these kinds of temperaments likely to be sought out in the foreseeable future in a way that maybe in the past people who were dealing with these challenges, because in some realms they are challenging, they might have in fact tried to downplay them. Is it something that people will sort of come out and talk about more openly now?
Yes, that's for sure. I think what we're seeing today is much more tolerance of neurodiversity. That is different ways of being cognitively. And say 30, 40 years ago, a lot of these people might have gotten jobs in basements or labs, pretty much hidden away from the mainstream, but doing amazing work. Whereas these days, they're probably designing amazing software and running the company and even owning the company.
What has been called the Anthropocene period, in which human activity truly shapes the planet, started with the Industrial Revolution at a time when nobody imagined what the outcome might be, and now we are in the thick of it and I guess unlikely to reverse it. Is that right?
That's right. In a geological sense, we've entered a new era, you know, like the Jurassic or the Pleistocene. It's called the Anthropocene, which means the age of man, which effectively means that the biggest determinant of our environment today is no longer natural. It's man-made. It's, you know, issues like whether it's controversial or not, climate change, the way we're dramatically transforming the landscape, the way we're creating an incredibly technologically advanced environment. And most people pretty much live indoors most of the time now.
And we are certainly products of that environment, but we are also sort of changing it. And there may be a point at which we begin to shape our own evolution in ways that that nature wouldn't have sort of selected for us.
Yes, that's very true. You know, for all human history, we have evolved through the process of unnatural selection, which, as you know, most of your listeners would know, is just about nature selecting for traits that happen to be beneficial in a particular environment. And it's happened by chance, or as people like Richard Dawkins would say, you know, operating like a blind watchmaker with great automaticity, not heading in any particular direction. And now, for the first time in human history, we have the opportunity to start to take charge of our own evolution, its direction and its pace. And we're starting to see that today. Well, we saw it first with, you know, test tube babies some decades ago. We're starting to see it more and more with the rapid advances in gene technology, the ability to start to splice genes, the ability to sort of even choose genes and perhaps even create, this is an extraordinary thing, new genes and implant them. And it's not just gene technology, but it's also the convergence of pharmaceutical developments, new drugs, drugs that are helping to make us smarter, sharper, and ultimately developments in artificial technology, which at the moment lie purely in the area of computers, but it's only a matter of time before these three aspects, that is computer, artificial technology, pharmacology, and gene splicing, start to converge. That's when we really take hold of our own evolution.
It's interesting that as comfortable as we are, as supportive as we are of using surgery or orthotics or gene therapies to correct a deformity of some kind, we're comfortable with that, and yet the idea of artificially enhancing something or someone who already functions normally, that's harder for people to justify. Can you talk about why we're uncomfortable with that idea?
Yeah, look, there's an issue of, well, there's a number of issues this raises. There's certainly the issue of fairness, because, you know, these enhancements are quite expensive, and if you can enhance yourself personally, to get ahead in the world, and let's face it, you know, it's an increasingly competitive world, and if you can get an edge in your cognitive abilities or in other areas, then a lot of people will take the risk and they'll pay the money. But there's always a price to pay, of course. So do we want a society where only the rich can afford to enhance themselves to a level where they become smarter and sharper and therefore more able to become more effective and perhaps make more money and therefore entrenching their position in society and perhaps even those of their children? So it raises some very, very serious issues. And then there's also the issue about how far do we want to move away from our natural state as being a human being? Because what defines us, of course, is not just our intelligence, but really fundamental dimensions such as compassion and love and our instinctual selves. And as we become more artificially advanced, enhanced, do we really want to lose touch with those dimensions that ultimately make us very human?
Yeah, because of course there's more to life. There's more to a successful life than you know, inventing a wonderful new product or running a company. And there would be people, I suppose, who would argue that their lives are very full and rich, even though they don't have the ability to do any of these things.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I would tend to agree with that view. That's why in the book I've made a number of sort of pointed out a number of dangers about this direction we're heading in. I mean, look, it's inevitable I guess that's the main point. These things are happening whether we like them or not. But I think it's up to us to take precautions and to apply some wisdom about the speed and the direction that these developments are heading, because the consequences are profound, and it's happening so fast now. You know, every day every week there's another new development in some sphere of related to human enhancement. But for everyday people, you know, a lot of people, as you say, they may think, well, hold on, I don't want to start messing with my own personal evolution. I've got a full life anyway, with, you know, kids to bring up and blah blah blah. But there's also a category we must recognise. There's a category of people in society, these high performing geeks, who maybe aren't so, shall we say, holistic in their view, and they're much more single minded and much more determined. And those people moving to the forefront of society with, you know, more power, more money, more capabilities to get things done, they're tending to drive us in a direction that may be sort of opposite to the sort of person you described earlier, and with quite a different set of values.
So what do we do to encourage moral and ethical and empathetic geeks to take over the world?
That is a very difficult question, I think. All geeks are different, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's not really fair to generalize. Obviously, some geeks are very enlightened. You know, some geeks have channeled enormous amounts of resources and through charities and so on. I think, for example, Bill and Melinda Gates have done extraordinarily good work in their support for, you know, fighting malaria and AIDS and so on. So, you know, there are geeks out there who have been phenomenally successful, and they've looked around the landscape and they thought, well, hold on, what do I do now? What do I use my resources, my geekdom? How do I make a better world? And that's a fundamental question that I think we should ask ourselves, and all geeks to ask themselves. How do I make the world better? How do I use these cognitive skills to improve the world, not just to better my own position? Because the fundamental issue here is, do we move forward as a society, as a collective, that is, through altruism and compassion and helping other people around us, or do we go the other route and believe that we only get ahead by focusing purely on the individual success?
What's interesting is that different societies have different ways of looking at that question and valuing either the individual success story or the collective success story.
That's very true. There's a debate that's been going on for a number of years now between, well, there's two sides. On one side, you've got the people like Richard Dawkins, I think he's an evolutionary biologist, and he wrote this very famous book called The Selfish Gene, which is sort of putting forward the idea that, you know, we're really driven much more on an individual level, and it's all about individual success, pulling ourselves up by the bootstrap. And I think that idea is widely spread, and particularly in the West, in the American culture, you know, it's all about the cowboy, not the posse, if you know what I mean. On the other side of the argument, you've got the view put forward by people like E.O. Wilson, who suggests, well, no, the reason humanity's been so successful is not so much because of the individual, but because we're able to collaborate. We're an altruistic species, and it's our power to cooperate that's taken humanity to the very top. And it's this debate that we're facing, and this debate underpins the rise of the geek as well and the direction we're heading.
My guest is author Mark Rader. His new book is called Unnatural Selection: Why the Geeks Will Inherit the Earth. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. We'll come back to the conversation in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Mark Rader. His new book is called Unnatural Selection, Why the Geeks Will Inherit the Earth. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Mark, we should note here, as you do in the book, that geeks are not a new thing. They were around in, you know, Mesopotamia with people, you know, scratching out multiplication tables. They were cloistered monks in the Middle Ages, illuminating manuscripts and memorizing texts by heart. They're not a new phenomenon.
No, no. I mean, you could argue that probably the wheel was invented by a geek. I mean, the geeks have been around a long time. The difference is, though, that they've now moved to the forefront for all the reasons, you know, we discussed earlier. I remember even the last couple of decades, we've seen that transition. I was working in a bank in Sydney, and I remember at the time there was this guy, very mysterious guy. We used to call him Darth Vader, very tall, used to wear a long black cape sort of thing, even in summer. In Sydney, summers can be quite hot. And he drove a big sort of motorbike, but he didn't really talk to anybody. I discovered later he was what was called a quant. He devised really complex algorithms for investment programs. But he was pretty much figuratively and physically locked away. But when I sort of moved to London some years ago, and I noticed that Darth Vader types weren't just sort of out the back, you know, they were strutting the corridors of power and they were running to big departments. And these guys, these quants, were you know, commanding huge salaries, you know, multi-million pound salaries, because so much of the bank's welfare and success depended on the work of these geeky quants. So, yes, geeks have always been around. And as you say, right from the days of, you know, Sumerian and Mesopotamia all the way through, but the acceleration of the geeks recently is bringing them right into the spotlight.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Jennifer in Fort Worth. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
Hi, Jennifer. Go right ahead, please.
Hi. How are you, Chris? First, I would like to thank you for what you do and the infinite knowledge and wisdom that you're spreading through the airwaves.
Oh, thank you.
I've had to purchase the last two books of interviews from people that have been on your show, from Suki Kim and Jenny Nordberg. But hello, Mark. Now I have to purchase your book because this is very interesting.
Oh, nice to hear.
Hello. My question is, or maybe the topic is about the collective consciousness. And when we have these overwhelming amounts of data, like you said, in the past 20 years or so, it's maybe grown tenfold, how much comes across our brain? And when decisions are made so quickly and conversations become just so rampant, across the nation, people are all talking about the same thing. My very specific question is about how quickly things manifest. We're creating what we're told and what we focus on these social websites. And just a very simple, quick example that can be replicated in my life and I'm sure in many other people's lives. I got a mailer from a conservational program. They wanted me to give $15 to, you know, support their efforts. It was mostly about, you know, we're killing these animals by drilling and all of this stuff, and we shouldn't be drilling, we shouldn't be doing these things, we need to conserve these animals. And my sister goes, well, yeah, what are they really doing though? I mean, you're not really going to help them. I mean, if you do this, but, you know, that pipeline thing, there's nothing's going to come of that. Well, that was 2 days ago when we had that conversation, and of course I did put my little $15 to help this conservationist movement. In North Texas, we wake up to news reports about a number of earthquakes that have been happening. What? And now social media, all you see are fracking. This is caused by fracking. We need to be conserving our land.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for your call. And I think, Mark, you may not be aware, but with the hydraulic fracturing, many people think that a recent spate of earthquakes in this part of the country may be related to that. And I suppose perhaps Jennifer's point was that we sort of skip from one topic to another together, as this is all we're talking about, and maybe the next big thing sort of diverts our attention again.
Yes, I think we see that a lot, and it is a worry. Look, social media, I think we're talking about social media primarily, has enormous power to do good. You know, it can galvanize people, it can get them all riled up and supporting change, and we've seen that happen in the Middle East, even though that's all gone a bit backwards lately. But nevertheless, we know that social media can move the world. The downside is that the addictive nature of social media and the way it works on our brains, it tends to create the so-called dopamine effect. And, you know, dopamine sort of gets us all anticipatory, you know, salivating over certain issues, but it doesn't actually provide the reward. You have to actually go out in the forest to eat the berry to get the reward. Dopamine forces you to go out there to look for it, but it doesn't actually satisfy. And similarly, social media gets us all riled up for a few days until we move on to the next subject. And so we're in danger of sort of encouraging this sort of really superficial, sort of titillating approach to life, where we live through this virtual interface called social media, and we kid ourselves we're actually doing something, where all we're doing is contributing or interacting with this constantly moving conversation that many people become addicted to. And not only that, but it tends to crowd out a lot of the space in our minds for deep thinking. I mean, if you really want to dwell and get to the heart of an issue, you need space, you need silence, you need really a sort of a place that's just not crowded out by the next big thing. I mean, in social media, they have this thing called fear of missing out, and, you know, people constantly checking their smartphones. And I don't think that makes people smarter at all. It may make them more connected, and much more connected with what's going on through this drip feed scenario. But I don't think it's really helpful in terms of people's intellectual development or ultimately their power to get things done and to understand why they need to be done.
If we evolve ourselves, either physiologically or simply culturally, into a species that survives and thrives based on the strength of our brains rather than the strength of our biceps and our backs, is that likely to change how aggressive we are physically? If we don't value being physically strong as a means of survival, are we less likely to look toward violence to achieve what we want?
I don't know the answer to that. There are conflicting views on this. You know, a lot of people who play, say, violent video games, right? They sort of get their violent tendencies expressed out through that mechanism because they might not be physically strong themselves, so they do it all on the internet. Some psychologists argue that that encourages violence in the real world. So when those people go out, they're more likely to do something bad. Other psychologists say, no, that allows them to get it out of their system. And for example, there's some strange anomalies, like, you know, in Japan, for example, where there's extreme violence in a lot of these video games, and yet they have one of the lowest crime rates in the world in real life violence. So as we evolve, as we become less, say, muscular, less physical, I'm not so sure that that's going to lead to a lessening of violence. It's also going to change the nature of violence, because in warfare, it's also being affected by geeks and this technology. Warfare is moving to a situation where there's more and more remote control systems inflicting violence, such as drones, you know, unmanned planes, missiles and so on. And even though the warriors themselves operating these systems might be quite geek-like, those systems have the potential to be a lot more lethal, especially as they become more autonomous and driven by artificial intelligence. Hopefully, the powers that be will use them wisely, but, you know, who knows the way history goes.
It is interesting to think about things like the drone program, which on the one hand, you know, I think many people like the idea of if we must be engaged in warfare, that we have the least possible risk to our service members. On the other hand, it does seem strange to have the power to you know, cause severe damage without even putting oneself in as much danger as it would take to be physically present to do that.
Yes, a few people have written by this. I think Peter Singer is one person, and he's made the point that it changes the nature of war, because war, traditionally, there's always been a risk, not just a risk of, you know, the nation's treasure and gold and money, but also a risk in terms of its courage, you know, because when you go to war, you're putting lives on the line, which is the greatest sacrifice of all. But when you start to automate war and make it more remote, this issue of courage changes, because you can, as you say, you can sit back in an air-conditioned office somewhere in America or, you know, Britain or anywhere else, and you can launch these weapons and not be physically harmed by them. But that's not to say, though, that a drone operator is not psychologically harmed. There's increasing evidence that, you know, even drone operators can suffer very extreme forms of PTSD, because for a number of reasons, the drones have such good cameras. Even though you're thousands of kilometres away, miles away, you're still, in a kind of visceral way, participating in the violence, even though you're witnessing it as in a video game, because you know you're responsible for it and you can see very clearly what's going on. And as a human being, we respond at that level. So even though we are able to move soldiers further back from the front line, it doesn't mean that those soldiers are less damaged. They're less damaged physically, sure, but the psychological consequences can be quite severe.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Andy in Red Oak. Hello, Andy.
Hey there.
Hi, go right ahead. We're doing well, thanks.
This is my first time calling, so I'm really excited. But I was going to ask him a question back to the geeks, kind of how they're coming up. Well, I'd like to consider myself a geek. However, I'm lacking about 6 hours with my math degree, so I feel like I don't really have much of a credential to go to a company or go to somebody who needs help with statistical analysis or data analysis. And I wondered, is there some way to make yourself look a little better, to incorporate yourself with somebody who needs statistical analysis, yet you're not quite done with the degree? Does that make sense?
Any I guess this is a very practical question for you there, Mark.
I'll try to answer. A lot of very, very successful geeks did not finish university. I don't think Bill Gates finished at Harvard. I certainly don't think that Steve Jobs finished. I'm not sure about, you know, Larry Ellison. I think that a lot of people who created these great companies, I think Sergey Brin and Larry Page, I'm not sure if they actually completed their degree. So in one sense, they all might be a little bit like you, have not quite completed their last bit of training, but that hasn't stopped them from going out there and doing great things. Look, if you really feel passionate about the work and you want to work in that field, just find a way, you know, be innovative, think outside the box, work, you know, think about developing an app, turn up, you know, send people to, send your CV to companies, say, look, here's the situation, and provide some examples of your work or your ideas or why you'd like to work for that company. I certainly would not hold yourself back because you haven't finished that last bit of the course. If you can finish it, great. But if you can't for whatever reason, then just keep pushing forward. Just be resilient and just expect that, you know, you might get, you know, 30 knockbacks before someone says, yep, I'll give this guy a chance.
What's it going to take, Mark, for us to craft artificial intelligence that really serves our needs but remains within our control?
Ah. That is quite a scary question. Nobody knows. Artificial intelligence is probably the greatest potential life changer of the next couple of generations, I would say. On the positive side, when machines can start to think for themselves, they could help us solve really intractable problems like climate change or all sorts of things that are, you know, asteroid threats or whatever. They can really, really help us, crop yields. The downside is that, as a lot of pundits have pointed out, if computers can start to reprogram themselves to become better and smarter and faster, then what is the upper limit of their development? Nobody knows. Their intelligence could become very, very, shall we say, powerful in relation to us. And as some anthropologists have pointed out, when a species confronts a more intelligent species, the less intelligent one doesn't do so well. On the positive side, though, we still are a long way away from having a machine that truly, truly thinks in a conscious way. And there's a very simple reason for that, and that is, despite all our technological prowess, we, as humans, don't even really know what consciousness is. So it's very hard to create something replicating human consciousness when there are so many different views on what that consciousness is comprised of.
We're speaking this hour with author Mark Rader about his new book, Unnatural Selection, Why the Geeks Will Inherit the Earth. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour from the studios of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation in Sydney with author Mark Rader. His new book is called Unnatural Selection, Why the Geeks Will Inherit the Earth. I know it's very early in the morning there, Mark Rader. And in fact, we're speaking to you from the future, right? It's January 8th where you are?
That's right, yes. Right.
Well, thank you very much.
We always have our New Year's parties very early.
That's right. Okay, so I want to talk about this. There are lots of different people wringing their hands over what the future will bring. How much do you think we are really how much do we have the power to really control the way this goes? I wonder if in some ways these cultural evolutions are as beyond our control as the kinds of natural evolutions that affect the changes in the bodies of bioorganisms.
They probably are beyond our control. I would say they're inevitable. They're driven by, you know, a lot of factors. Money is one. Mm. Yeah, commercial interests are huge. The military, obviously, developing areas of artificial intelligence. Pharmacology, wanting to help people, you know, have longer, healthier lives. And also just the fact that humans have a great desire to improve themselves through whatever means. So if these, shall we say, products come up, if someone said, look, I can give you a pill that makes you 30% smarter or have perfect memory or enables you to, you know, live for 150 years in reasonably good health, people would probably mortgage their house for such a pill. So, these things are going to happen. And the question is, what can we do about it? How can we set direction? That's a question of governments. It's a question of community. It's also a question of individuals and the way they interrelate with their families and their friends about sort of the choices they make. So, but these things are happening. We just have to wave the traffic in the direction it's going, but hopefully set some road rules for where the roads are heading.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Brett in Louisville. Hello, Brett.
Hey, that was a great lead into my question. It's kind of a lighthearted question, but I was actually flipping through the channels one day and saw this movie called Stupidocity. And the whole premise of the movie was based on the fact that intelligent people have less children than less intelligent children or less intelligent people. And it tips the scales of democracy in the future and things just go into utter chaos. And that's a reality, unfortunately. And I'm wondering how you feel that'll play in, how democracy will play into this whole thing. I'd just love your opinion on it.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, no, it's a very good question. It raises those fundamental issues of fairness, equality, justice. Because you're right. Smart people tend to have fewer children. And also, smart people tend to marry other smart people or have children with other smart people, therefore reinforcing that tendency. But then again, you know, smart people have always tended to be pretty choosy about who they have progeny with. But over the long term, the way genetics seems to work is that even with that sort of concentration of smart people into certain groups and intermarrying, there's still enough random mutation, there's still enough interaction, there's still such a huge gene pool that we're dealing with, you know, between 6.5 billion people now moving up to 9 billion people on the planet. The opportunities for random changes and sort of different sort of groups of genes racially, individually, across boundaries. So there's never going to be a real problem about only having a small group of smart people running the world with fewer and fewer kids. But it also plays into the issue of why these enhancements are probably going to turn out to be quite popular. Because as they become more effective and more useful for wider groups, and eventually the price will come down, we will probably see the emergence of a cognitive arms race, where, you know, more and more people are going to join in to try to use whatever advantage or shortcut they can get to the top.
Do you worry at all that we will, if we're focused specifically on intellectual ability, and certainly things like the arts and creative pursuits require that, but if we're looking just at sort of pure IQ or however you want to define that, that we'll miss out on other kinds of intelligence that we might also benefit from having and from enhancing in our society?
Absolutely. Really, you can have a really high IQ, but it doesn't necessarily make you a wise person, and it certainly doesn't ensure that you're going to be a creative person or a loving person or a compassionate person. To be artistic or creative, you often don't need to be acutely bright in a cognitive sense because you're drawing on so many other aspects of what it means to be a human. And we don't even know where creativity comes from. It almost seems to come from the ether. People who write great books or paint paintings or write songs sometimes admit, well, I don't know. I just seem to be transcribing it. It didn't seem to come from me. So there are very many mysteries here. So we'd be foolish to think that all the laurels will go to acutely intelligent people with high IQs because they won't.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Mary on the line in Colleyville. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I had a comment that ties in on several levels with what you guys have been talking about. This is also sort of movie-related. When the movie E.T. came out, the creature was kind of a bit of controversy because of his body type, and evidently they put a lot of thought and research into creating something that would function well in the future, being that his life would be strictly about computers and not, he wasn't built for walking. He had big eyes to look at a computer screen, a long finger to push buttons, and didn't move very much. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, and he ate a lot of candy, as far as we can recall from the movie as well.
Yeah.
He did. I don't think we're in danger of having an ET-type body. Look, I think that bodies evolve very, very, very slowly. But it's possible that our brains and cognitive processes may evolve much faster, our neurological wiring, you might say. Also, even as our brains evolve, you know, we need our bodies. We feel through our bodies. We have our instinctual cells. We draw actually a lot of our information about how to interact with the world from our bodies. I think one of the fastest growing developments is very interesting, actually, in psychology and helping people with all sorts of problems such as mental illness, is body-based therapies. Some people have even moved away from the pure talk therapy to incorporate a bottom-up therapy as well. You know, these areas of somatic experiencing developed by people like Peter Levine and also Bessel van der Kolk. We're finding that if we want to have direct connection and to help our minds, one of the best ways to do it is through the activities of our bodies, which seem to act as a direct gateway to the more primitive aspects of our brain, the mammalian brain, the brainstem, and so on, which that can't be accessed just through talk therapy. So our bodies are here to stay for all sorts of reasons, not just to get us around in the world, but we're finding that our bodies themselves contain an enormous amount of intelligence created over millions of years of evolution.
And of course, there's the sensory pleasure of inhabiting a body, at least a healthy body, that people wouldn't be willing to give up, it doesn't seem.
Oh, absolutely. It would be a pretty sad state of affairs to be living just in our minds, I think.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Carlos on the line in Louisville. Hello, Carlos.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very looking forward to getting the book in the future. My question kept evolving throughout all the other people's phone calls coming in. My question is, what is the actual ability for us to create an artificial intelligence that takes the PTSD out of the soldier, meaning it decides to kill and not kill? And what is the ability, what is the actual outcome of that ever happening? Because I know that artificial intelligence would rely on us maintaining it. So if it's a drone, it would have to go back to an avionics personnel. So somebody, therefore, would be responsible for it. So I guess prolonged future, somebody would create PTSD. But what if we created an intelligence that took the PTSD completely out of the picture? And is that technology out there that you know of?
Before you answer, Carlos, would you trust an artificial intelligence to do that for us?
You know, honestly, I come from an avionics background.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very simple to look through someone's, glass pit screen in a fighter plane and see an enemy plane coming at you. And the computer already knows, hey, this is not a friend. This isn't a friendly. We're locked on. We're ready to fire. But it's ultimately a human's choice to take the kill or not. So what happens whenever our government says, hey, we want to take that option out completely. We just want to go ahead and take the kill and keep our borders safe or whatever else. What?
Thanks so much for your call, Carlos. That's a heavy question, Mark. What do you think?
It is a very heavy question. You know, the consequences, if we completely remove the consequences of war, the danger is it starts to impinge upon our, I guess, our essential morality as a society. If war is made too easy, if it's too automated, if it's too lacking any sort of consequences to us, then I think it removes one of the barriers that we've traditionally had that prevents us from becoming too warlike or too dominating as a society. But look, I doubt we'd get to that stage. I mean, what that gentleman I think is talking about is, you know, what sort of algorithms would we develop that enabled a drone to operate completely autonomously? I'm pretty confident that whatever those algorithms are, they would have lots of safeguards built in to ensure that, you know, collateral damage is minimized and that only the target and the target is verified as much as possible. So these things are not entered into lightly. And the military, you know, you have to hand it to them. Overall, they've been, I think, quite responsible, very responsible in the way they've gone about developing these programs so far. You know, we're not about to sort of give unfettered, let these sort of programs run amok in the world. The public outcry would be too severe, and I don't think it would be in the interest of the military either, because there'd be a blowback.
Do you feel like enough people in the world are asking the kinds of questions that you're asking and exploring these things in a critical way so that even if we are accepting that these changes are imminent and perhaps inevitable, we continue to sort of push back against the things that we recognize are bad for us as a human race?
No, I don't think the questions are being asked enough. I think we're stumbling blindly into a future that is both exciting and also, you know, fraught with great dangers. And I think we need to have this debate, this discussion, at a very profound level and a far-reaching level about what are the consequences of human enhancement? What are the consequences of a cognitive arms race? Is it right that we are going to shortly enable people to really fundamentally change their nature without really thinking about what that means for our species in the long term? These questions need to be dealt with. A lot of people are delving into them, but as I think one of the callers mentioned earlier, it tends to fall into the sort of fast-moving, superficial social media trickle discussion, where it needs a very different sort of discussion.
The new book by author Mark Rader is called Unnatural Selection, Why the Geeks...
Chris, I should just correct that. It's actually Mark Roeder.
Roeder, I'm so sorry, and I've been getting that wrong the whole hour. Thank you so much for the correction. I deeply apologize for that. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
The book is Unnatural Selection, Why the Geeks Will Inherit the Earth. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones from Christina Martinez. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.